Hi everyone, my name is Rhonda Jefferson and I want to welcome you to Mystifyingly Missing. Mystifyingly Missing is a podcast and YouTube channel that explores both solved and unsolved disappearances, as well as those that are famous and not quite so famous. This is a pretty new show. I'll be recording this both for a podcast and a video, so I will add pictures of specific people or things when they are available to the YouTube video. But I'll try to leave links in the description if that's possible so everybody can look at the material. Now, each episode may discuss events that some may find disturbing. This can include, but is not limited to, violence, murder, suicide, and abuse. Now, every disappearance is important, yet some seem to make the headlines using descriptions such as bizarre, unbelievable, strange, and maybe even mystifying. Other stories are pushed aside and relegated to the last page of a newspaper or the bottom of a list of online articles. So unless there's something scandalous or something not seen before, some of these disappearances are not given the priority that they deserve, and their loved ones are left to wonder why. Why did my child, sister, brother, wife not get the same amount of attention? Now, I'll also try to look at some historical disappearances that to some people are completely mysterious, but may actually have plausible explanations. Now, some enduring disappearances happened long before social media, and media and communications, though, in any era can play a role with disappearances. Even if well-intentioned, you have to look at the media and see sometimes if the coverage helps or hinders. Now, also, we have to look at what are the motives of those that cover the disappearance. Is it for the salacious details, or do they want to get to the point of why or how this disappearance occurred? Maybe some people are truly trying to help, but others may just have an agenda to further. Now, to address current events, I had thought about this podcast months ago when I saw a documentary about Madeleine McCann, and it mentioned that there were some children that were missing in the same area, and they were young boys. They received little or no coverage, and all I could think of were the parents of those children wondering why their children didn't get the same coverage. Now, as a parent, I'm thinking, on the one hand, I'm glad that Madeleine got the coverage that she had because every child deserves media coverage if they're disappeared or if they've disappeared, but the other children deserved it as well. So, it's hard sometimes to digest that those who are meant to tell us the news may focus on one story rather than another. And there are a lot of stories that have yet to be heard and voices have yet to be heard. So I'm going to try to explore disappearances in a slightly different light and maybe try to figure out why some do get the coverage that they get. Also, I would like to ask if you find this type of content interesting to please subscribe to the channel, like, or leave a comment, or both. It depends on how you're watching or listening to this as to what options you may have. But what this does is move this up into the algorithm where if people search for certain words, they can find this episode and channel more easily. Now, I do want to give an update on something that I covered with the last episode, and that was the missing person, Woody Dickerson. I did find out while trying to get an update about the case that he was actually sighted on November 1st, and it was his mother's neighbor who noticed him standing flush against the house, the backyard, and so she knew that he was missing. She found his wife's number, called it, and found out that both his wife and mother-in-law were actually in the front of the house. So, we weren't there. We can't say for sure what happened, but there seems to have been at least some type of contact. Now, the reason that some of this came to light is that the next day on social media, his wife, said that she hadn't heard his voice for a period of time, which, he was there at the house. It seemed to have been a conversation going on. Now, what I'm going to ask though is it seems like Woody still needs help. We don't know if he even got into her car because she did pull the car to the back at some point, but the neighbor couldn't see and the windows were tinted so she couldn't see if he got in there. So, it sounds as though he, still needs help and support from the community and from his wife. We'll just have to wait to see exactly how, everything plays out on this. So with, all of the background information about the podcast, we want to go on now to cover today's story. And sometimes when I'm actually going over a story, I hate to even call it that. I get stuck on the word story. Whether on this podcast or another that I have, most of the cases deal with tragedy. And feeling or calling it a story makes me feel that I'm somehow depreciating the seriousness of the event, almost like it's a fiction story told for entertainment, and it's not. Looking at the pictures of the young boys in this case, it can take me back to a time when newspapers and magazines, books just had flourishing illustrations of rosy-cheeked babies and curly hair. But when a person is drawn, they are idealized, and it's not a true representation always of the subject. But looking at the pictures of the young boys in this case, I can almost picture them gracing, a Hans Christian Andersen book or being on the cover of a serial magazine that, really targeted mothers or grandmothers. So it sometimes takes us to a world where it may feel like it's actually a tale or a story, but it's not. But on the other hand, if I refer to it as a case or an event, it almost makes me feel like I'm sterilizing it, that there's not as much personal touch to it. So, really, though, what else would we call this? It was a tragedy, it was a crime, it was an event, but all of them just don't seem like they're strong enough to describe what happened. So, I guess if I have to choose a word to decide, I'm going to say that today we will cover the case of little Charlie Brewster Ross. So who was he? While his name might seem familiar to those interested in the history of true crime, others may not know the name. He has had a profound impact on police procedure when involving kidnapping cases and ransom demands. Charlie was the very first confirmed person to be kidnapped for ransom within the US. You might want to ask, why do I say confirmed? Now, what I'm going to say in the next few moments is really just more of a feeling that I have. It's at that time, there really, for one, wasn't as much record keeping. There wasn't an understanding. There had never been a documented case of kidnapping at that point. So, I know there are some other things that, or realms of things I'm not even going to get into in this episode, but will in others, that, if we really looked at society, there were kidnappings that occurred on a regular basis that, to a degree, were deemed legal. So, there were other kidnappings before this, but there was no procedure. If we see, a TV show, whether it's a documentary or some type of, drama, we would know that if a person receives a note that says, do not call the authorities, we would still, call the authorities. There wasn't that protocol back then because people didn't know. So, it could have been a family may or may not have been able to pay the ransom. If they had paid the ransom, they just figured, okay, it's good, we have our son or daughter back. And didn't report anything. Now, if the child ended up being killed, going back to record keeping, it wasn't always the greatest, so it may have gone unreported. So there are just so many things that I think may have happened, they're just not documented, that makes this the first documented case of a kidnapping for ransom within the US. Now, some people may have actually found a kidnapping for ransom to be scandalous, or even just that a person had gone missing. If you're familiar with the Dorothy Arnold case, she was a socialite in New York that went missing, yet her parents hired private investigators first to try to find her. And it was around 30 days before they reported it to the police. So there was a great delay in that case, and she has never been found. Now, in the summer of 1874, Charlie Ross, who was four, and his brother Walter Ross, who was six, even though a couple of sources say five and one says eight. So this is kind of proving the point about record keeping. They were playing outside in Germantown, Pennsylvania, an upper class area of Philadelphia. Crime was not really as prevalent there, or just possibly not as reported, and most people would have felt safe. The children, who were the sons of Christian Ross, a dry goods merchant, and Sarah Ross, who was out of town on vacation in Atlantic City at this time, these boys were befriended by some men who would come around and talk to them during the day, really ingratiating the youngsters and made them feel safe. Today, parents would be afraid to let their children out in some areas, for fear of injury or even abduction. This was not as much of a concern back then. So when on July 1st in 1874, the men asked the boys if they wanted to get some free candy and fireworks. So of course they said yes. They did not distrust these men. So they got into the horse and buggy and they started towards a store. Now, they set off on this trip not knowing that only one would return. As they started to get further away from their home, Charlie did begin to get upset. The carriage stopped at that point, and the men gave Walter some money to go into the store and buy some fireworks. I can see him probably just, running in there excited. And when he left the store, though, he must have been surprised and confused to see that Charlie, the men, the horse, and the buggy were gone. So, back then, there's no cell phones. There's not a way for him to contact his father, but there's no mention on how he got home that I could find, but he did get home. Now, a ransom letter was received, and so though there's not any information about the time frame, it does sound like, it was a while before he got the ransom letter. The handwriting at times could have been hard to read, and the spelling, sometimes made it more difficult. And what I'll do is I'll put the wording up on the screen here and I'll read you an example. And you can see how it flowed on the screen. Mr. Ross, be not uneasy, you son Charlie Brewster. He all right. We as got him and no powers on earth can deliver him out of our hand. You will have to pay us before you get him from us. And pay us a big cent too. If you put the cops hunting for him, you is only defeating you own end. We is not, or we is got him fit, so no living power can gets him from us alive. If any approach is made to his hiding place, that is the signal for his instant annihilation. If you regard his life puts no one to search for him, you money can fetch him out alive, and no other existing powers. Don't deceive yourself and think the detectives can get him from us, for that is one impossible where from us in few day, or hear from us in few day. So I think you have the idea here. This letter, though, set off some red flags to me. There would sometimes be a sentence with five or six mistakes, whether it be grammar or spelling. Then you would have a sentence where there were barely any. You also have him or have the writer misspelling some very easy words or words that he would have seen every day, such as you. But at the same time, when he spelled annihilation, he only missed it by one letter. It was still misspelled, yes, but it was quite, a long word, to be spelled even to that degree of correctness. My thoughts are, and I think later on it was, I don't want to say brought out in the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, but the police did look at the linguistics of the letter. So even though this was prior to the Lindbergh kidnapping, I wonder if the kidnappers thought, okay, well, we'll make this look like either we're not as educated as some people, and they'll just start to think of us as not being as smart as them, and that way they can let their guard down, something to that extent. And while that may kind of seem out there for this time period, once we get a little bit further in this story, there's actually going to be a part that shows that they do think ahead very, very much. So it would not surprise me then, especially knowing this, future detail, which I'll get into later, that maybe this whole letter and the way it was worded was, actually on purpose. Now, the ransom was $20,000, which is over $400,000 in today's money. Now, while the family lived in a very wealthy part of the city, he didn't have that kind of money anymore. What had happened is the year before there had been a market crash, and the fi family finances were not as great as a lot of people may have believed. Now, Mr. Ross had actually lost all of his money. He was in debt, and as far as wanting to pay the ransom, he did, but he did not have the money to do so. So, in desperation, he went to the police. Now, I do want to make it clear, we don't know how much time had actually passed, and this is the first time he's going to the police. So after he did go to law enforcement, Charlie really became part of the public conscience, not just in Pennsylvania, but throughout the whole country. Now, something of importance to note again is this letter did not come the same day as the abduction. It came some days later, and that is when Mr. Ross went to the police. Now, in today's world, this might even make Mr. Ross seem suspicious because he delayed, taking this information to the police. Now, the wealthy of the city actually kind of, got together and, they tried to raise money and pay for detectives to try to find the child. There was a song written named Bring Back Our Darling that was composed by Dexter Smith and W.H. Brockway. P.T. Barnum even got into this by paying for Christian's travel arrangements, but bringing Christian to the house and offering a $10,000 reward. And that if Charlie was recovered as a result of that reward, Charlie would then go on with the traveling sideshow for the circus. Now Christian did agree to the reward, but said that instead of having Charlie travel with the circus, Christian would find a way to repay the money. So, you would recover your child and then just turn him over to someone else. It doesn't make sense. So in total, the Rosses received about 23 letters. And also, we have to remember, again, no cell phones. And we can't even say that having a phone in the house was a luxury because the phone was not even invented. So much of the correspondence was through mail by the kidnappers, because of course the kidnappers weren't going to give their address to have them send something back. And though the family did attempt to pay for Charlie's return, the kidnappers never showed up. And as far as Mr. Ross, he tried to use the personal ads to communicate with the kidnappers. We can sometimes see this as a trope used in some older TV shows and movies. It would be a way of communication without a direct link to an individual, such as if Mr. Ross was calling a burner phone using today's terms. But this was not successful either. So Charlie's story spread across the country. While, the phone line had not been invented, there was still the telegraph. Newspapers were being printed throughout the country, and even though it might take a little while for a story to get across the country, it would. So soon the Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey police departments were all working together and lending support. People in California knew of Charlie and the Ross family plight, And the New York Herald said, "Never within the history of the Quaker City has a circumstance arisen that so wholly monopolized its public press, or that has called to Philadelphia a greater number of correspondents from elsewhere. So great is its importance and so direct its bearing upon the human family in general, that no particulars of the affair should be able to escape public observation, nor should any of its details be able to pass without general comment." To note, the Quaker City is also another name for Philadelphia. So parents across the country, regardless of their socioeconomic status, all felt compassion for this beleaguered family. Now, members of the police worked relentlessly to try to find this little boy. Captain Hines of the Philadelphia Police Department ran the investigation. They did try to use the media as much as they could to garner attention and even offered a $300 reward. Time went by, and the only thing the Ross family seemed to receive were more ransom letters, which did eventually end after the 23. Then one night in December, not even in Pennsylvania, two men were shot during a burglary in a New York judge's home. Joseph Douglas and William Mosher were the burglars. So on December 13th, Judge Charles Van Brunt's home was broken into. Now, his brother Holmes Van Brunt lived next door, and he gathered people to confront the intruders. Mosher and Douglas had chosen to break into the wrong home, it seems. Holmes Van Brunt's group, they were armed and shot. Mosher died immediately, but Douglas lingered on for a while. He said that they had kidnapped Charlie, but only Mosher had known where the child was held. We can't be as sure of the exact wording, as people were in shock at the scene, both due to the shooting and then finding out these were the men that had taken Charlie Ross. And let me just get the letter for that. Like I said, bear with me because I'm learning how to do the video here. What Douglas is reported to have said is, "It's no use lying now. Mosher and I stole Charlie Ross from Germantown. God knows I tell you the truth. I don't know where he is. Mosher knew." So there were points that could not be agreed upon, such as if Charlie was still alive or whether or not he could be returned. And, little Walter was taken to New York to view the bodies. Mosher did have a distinguishing feature. His nose was partially destroyed by either cancer or syphilis. And when Walter had described him, he had described a misshapen nose. So with the identification of these two as the kidnappers, all that was left was to see if Charlie can be returned. And he wasn't. Now, in this case, and I know it may seem a little controversial in some ways, but there was somebody who was arrested, but there was absolutely no evidence against this person. And I'm not saying the person is innocent or guilty. I'm just saying at the time of the arrest, there was nothing that, was evidence for this person. So, looking at it from today's viewpoint, there would be some legal issues in the fact that he was arrested. So to tell you a little bit more about him. Now, Mosher's brother-in-law was a man named William Westervelt, and he was eventually arrested for being involved in the kidnapping. He was a former Philadelphia police officer who was labeled as disgraced and was arrested, again, before there was any evidence pointing to him. The police insisted he was involved, but he said he wasn't, that he was innocent. Now, Walter also had indicated he did not see a third man or this man with the kidnappers. But, at least as reports say, Christian Ross did have a conversation with him, and during that time, he said that Charlie was alive. So, if he said that, it would seem to indicate that he at least knew about the kidnapping, not that he was necessarily involved. He also made this statement after he was arrested and was in prison. So this is where there may be some legal wrangling if this had happened today. And I'm not a legal expert. This is just, kind of looking at things where I've seen cases before, as to why possibly, it could have actually caused some issues. By arresting him before there was actually any proof, it could be said that there was no legal standard for the police to have arrested him. And since the confessions came after his arrest, they could be considered what the term is used is fruit of the poisonous tree, meaning that these confessions came as a result of arresting him, but arresting him was not proper either. So theoretically, those confessions could have been thrown out. And I'm using the term confession, because when you say that someone's alive or not, that shows that you were a part of the situation. So, you know, again, just looking at it through today's lens, it may not fly. So, you know, the police, I feel, should have been a little bit more careful. Eventually, Westervelt was sentenced to 6 years. He was found, he was acquitted of the kidnapping, but found guilty of a conspiracy. Now, this is the part where, you know, I said that the kidnappers actually did have some forethought. The kidnappers were very well known, apparently, in New York. So even though they probably wouldn't get as much money for someone in a different, you know, area, because New York really was the hub of things, there was talk that they were interested in actually kidnapping one of the Vanderbilts. You know, the Vanderbilts, who are probably historically one of the most moneyed and wealthy families ever. But again, they were afraid that, you know, they would be recognized or the police would automatically think of them. So they decided to go to Pennsylvania. And in a way that, you know, kind of was smart, because they had family that lived there, so they would have that contact. So I just think this goes to show that the kidnappers really did try to think things through as much as they can. They hadn't even been caught, probably weren't on the radar, and if they hadn't broken into the judge's house, you know, we probably wouldn't even have this much information. So while the Ross family did not have the financial means to, you know, keep going with the search like they had, they, of course, were not going to give up. Christian wrote a book, The Father's Story of Charlie Ross, the Kidnapped Child, and proceeds went to continue the search. He also wanted to make sure Charlie's case was remembered, so he started to give talks around Boston. So, like I said, the parents never gave up, but Christian did die in 1897, and his wife in 1912. People continuously claimed to either be Charlie, or they said they thought they might be. And there's some conflicting information here. One article said they spoke with over 500 people, but Walter said in another interview it was 1,000. So this interview was given for the 50th anniversary of the kidnapping, and that year was 1924 when they did the article. He did say that he still continued to get letters regarding this and people claiming to be Charlie. So what I think it was is possibly his parents got around 500 people, and they spoke to around 500 people before they both died. And then later letters just still continued to come in. And at that point, it went to over 1,000 people, at least, that they had spoken to. Now, 10 years after the article came out, so in 1934, a man from Phoenix named Gustav Blair, he said that he was Charlie. He was 69 years old, so the age range, though approximate, was, you know, pretty close and correct. He went to court to have himself be declared Charlie Ross. He said he remembered being kidnapped and living in a cave, and later someone adopting him, and that adopted father told him that he was Charlie. Now, the remaining Ross family did not believe this. Walter said, "The idea that my brother is still alive is not only absurd, but the man's story seems unconvincing. We've long ago given up hope that Charles ever would be found alive." So even though the parents never gave up hope, the siblings, it seems, had. Now, whether it was due to the distance of traveling to Arizona, not understanding the implications, maybe complacency after speaking with so many men or all three, no one from the Ross family or one of their representatives went to contest the facts in court. So, in fact, the court did actually declare Gustav Blair Charlie Ross in 1939. And we have to remember that this is a default judgment. It really had no proof to go along with it, but because no one was there to contest it, it went through. And if Blair thought that this would change the Ross's minds, he was very mistaken. They did not acknowledge him. He didn't inherit anything. And that would have been difficult, though, because Mrs. Ross had died 20 years earlier. Blair did try to sell his story to Hollywood and even moved there, but the story didn't sell. His wife and he then moved to Germantown, Pennsylvania for a while, but he did not garner any interest from his newfound family. And the media didn't really give him much attention, so he moved back to Phoenix. He only lived for 4 years after the ruling until 1943. He never, ever changed saying that he was actually Charlie. I have a few thoughts here. The attempt to sell the story, I mean, it was a way to get money. We don't know what his financial circumstances were. He may have even believed that he was truly Charlie, and he did end up trying to capitalize on it. I did also find pictures of Walter and Christian, as well as Gustav Blair, and there is some type of resemblance. But it could also be argued that Gustav came across the 1924 article, saw some type of resemblance in the pictures, and decided to, you know, see if his plan would work. Now, there have never been any official DNA tests done, but through the use of genetic genealogy, it does seem to indicate that Gustav Blair was a man named Nelson Miller. But again, nothing was official. This was done through some of his relatives. I find it very interesting that they were able to come up with a completely different name. So we don't know if possibly, you know, he was kidnapped and they used different names, or if he just used different names for other nefarious reasons. Now, Charlie's story did remain in the public's consciousness well after he had gone missing. So when FDR came to speak at the Democratic National Convention, someone decided to play a prank. And what they did is they went to the press and the press corps and asked them to announce over the intercom if Charlie Ross could please come to the press area. The press soon, you know, realized this was a prank and did not do it. Also, many people think that the saying, don't take candy from strangers, is actually derived from this event. So this case affected people all across America. This made people fear for their children, and not just from things that they couldn't control, such as illness and disease, but from callous actions of other humans. And while the crime itself was vile, it also caused torture to all of Charlie's loved ones, never knowing if he was alive or dead, and if alive, was he suffering? While I've seen some sites will actually state that the case is solved, relying on the deathbed confession of Douglas, the trial for an accomplice that had little or no evidence, and the claims of a man who had no documentation to back things up. You know, of course, do believe that Mosher and Douglas were involved. I don't think Westervelt was involved in the actual kidnapping, but he had to know. But as far as Blair, not really sure. So there was more of a legacy that Charlie had. There is a website called The Charlie Project. So I'm going to read some things directly from their website in a moment. It's a website where you can find a list of missing persons, as well as Jane and John Doe's. The site is meant to allow for a collection of all missing persons so that other people are made aware, as well as being able to compare them, unfortunately, to the lists of Jane and John Doe's. Now, unlike some other organizations that may actively participate in a search or fund different aspects of an investigation, The Charlie Project has one purpose, which is to serve as a clearinghouse of sorts. And in my opinion, something like this is needed. It has an objectiveness and equality to the amount of coverage. And while, you know, they may gather some information from sources such as newspaper and media, it's also a site used by law enforcement and even the loved ones of a missing person. They can go on and add information to the site. So I'll read some of, you know, the things that the Charlie Project does and does not do. And this is directly from their website under the FAQs. It says, what does the Charlie Project do? It might be easier to explain what the Charlie Project does not do. The Charlie Project does not have any offline presence. It is not affiliated with private investigators or law enforcement. It does not distribute flyers of missing persons. It does not actually investigate missing person cases or homicides. It does not try to match missing persons with unidentified bodies. It does not accept tips from the public about any missing persons, cases, or homicides. Okay, so you might ask then, what does it do? The Charlie Project serves as a publicity vehicle and clearinghouse of information for missing persons. It attempts to catalog as much information as possible about as many cases as possible into a database as a publicity investigative aid for the public and law enforcement. To help solve cases, a wide variety of sources are used, such as other databases, news, media accounts, law enforcement, information supplied by friends and family members of the missing, and books. And all the information contained there is summarized for each missing person, and they have their own Charlie Project case file. And the quote has ended now. I'm just talking about some of the aspects of it. So in this way, instead of having to track down, say, 20 different newspapers and finding different articles, you can actually have a consolidation of all the information. So this is Charlie's legacy, being the first kidnapped for ransom child in the U.S. that was documented. It changed the way people handled kidnappings. And, you know, a century later, more than a century, a site was made with his name to try to help find other missing persons. So here ends our story of little Charlie Ross. And I want to thank everybody for listening today. Like I said earlier, if you are able to subscribe or like or comment, that would really help move the channel forward. All of my information, the sources that I used, will be in the description of the podcast or video. And please feel free to send me, you know, any email if there's a case that you want me to look into. You know, there's a couple cases I'm looking at right now, including one that I'm going to try to look at through the viewpoint of the missing person, because in this case, it's an unidentified person. So what that actually means is someone was found, his remains were found in 1931. They were never identified, and given the situation, I really don't know if they'll ever be identified, but, you know, he lost his life, but he also lost his name. That's something that you should never lose. And, you know, just there is a family out there missing someone, but it was 1931 and times were very different. So, very interested in trying to, you know, get that case together. But I hope you all join me again next week. I hope to get a more stable schedule, because sometimes I'm not able to get the episodes out at an exact interval. So I'm going to try to, you know, record some episodes a little early. And that way, if something comes up, I can put that episode in. So thank you for your patience on that. And again, thank you for tuning in. And I will talk to everybody later.